This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. So if you're between the ages of, let's say, 25 and 54, a question you've probably asked yourself is, will I be able to retire at age 65? But is that the right question? Maybe the real question is, will you want to retire at age 65? Which is why we've called up John D. Stoll, who writes for the Wall Street Journal. And John, your piece is headlined, "The End of Retirement." This grew out at, you're 42. This grew out of a conversation with your financial advisor?
Yeah, I mean, my financial advisor and my dad is actually probably the model for the way that I look at my own retirement aspirations. He's in his mid-70s. He's working 3 days a week, not because he has to, but because he wants to. And then if you fast forward, my financial planner and I, you know, we're talking about socking away, big chunk of my income, as a lot of people do, into a 401k, and whether or not I was planning for retiring at 65 or just more financial flexibility. I mean, 65 is not old anymore. It hasn't been old since the 1970s. I mean, you really do have a revolution in healthcare.
It depends on what you do for a living, right? So if you're a symphony conductor, you're going to die with the baton in your hand at the age of 90. If you're digging coal in West Virginia, you might want to be out of there by 65.
And this is the sort of backdrop for every conversation that we always have on retirement. At 65, will the resources be there for a comfortable retirement? The thing that I think, if I'm a 45-year-old in the manufacturing environment, an environment where I'm working hourly, something where you're not the columnist for the Wall Street Journal sitting up in an ivory tower, I get that. And you're thinking about this, you're saying healthcare is going to appreciate, is going to go up. A fixed income on stocks and bonds, bonds in particular, is not going to return at the level of inflation. So you almost have to prepare for a life of some kind of work after retirement, after official retirement from maybe what you're doing today.
Are you finding employers who are telling their retirement age employees, hey, could you stick around?
Well, yeah, I think there's two sides of this coin. I think one is employers are finding that the younger worker, they look at work much the way that the previous generations may have looked at church or family. Birth rates are down. Church membership is down. Community organizations struggle to find members. We work more. Younger people spend more time at work. So they are engaged and locked into this as a primary community for themselves. So the short answer is no. I don't think corporate America and a lot of even smaller companies have thought about this trend holistically. I think they're still thinking about that 401k kicking in at 65 years old and most of these people going off and doing part-time jobs or and leaving the company. But there are companies. I talked to one in particular, and this is a proxy for, I think, a growing number of smaller, maybe private, very culture-driven companies. I talked to Patagonia, for instance, the outdoor company. They make swanky outdoor clothes. What has happened is, as the company has aged, many of their initial workforces, the people who helped start the company, are now aging out. They're graying, and they're in their mid-60s. They don't want to leave. For one, it's a fun place to work. They take a couple days off a month to go surfing. So not typical workplace. But as an example, they're saying these people are our quote-unquote elders, and we're idiots if we let them just walk out the door if they're not ready. So they're transitioning them into advisory jobs, education jobs in the company to help train up the younger workers in terms of manufacturing processes or environmental policies and things like that. On a broader scale, there's companies like AT&T, shipbuilders, automakers who are engaged in what we would call reskilling efforts. So I may have been an accountant for the last 20 years of my life. We don't need as many accountants or we don't need as many mechanical engineers. Can we transition these people with a high potency for work, definitely the intellectual skill set to figure out tough problems and analyze solutions? Can we move these people into jobs that are 21st century jobs? And a lot of those reskilling efforts are beginning to take shape, and people in their 50s are engaged in those efforts. So yes, you're starting to see it at the beginning, but I don't think by any means this is a situation that's been fully attacked.
Well, I'm a baby boomer. Don't the baby boomers have a responsibility at some point to get out of the way to give the millennials a chance, because they're already upset with us for a number of things?
Yep.
And if we just hang out in our jobs and they're stuck underneath us, they're going to be even more resentful.
I think baby boomers can probably get ready to be reporting to younger people at some point. You know, like you said earlier, this is very situational, and part of the situation here is that there are many people of a certain age in their 50s, 40s, 30s, it's becoming more common to not have the resources to retire. So even though it'd be nice if we had this kind of clean, smooth transition from one generation to the next, okay, we're making room for you in the workforce. Number one, we don't have enough skilled people. So that is something that the labor market necessitates, is that we keep older people. Number two, all the smart people and the economists say that this is the trend that is actually going to happen, is the growing part of the workforce will not be young people. It will be people 55 and older. That will be the growing chunk of the workforce going forward for many decades. And then the last thing is, in as much as it might be nice for the old guy to get out of the way, it's also nice if that person works a few more years and takes some of the pressure off of the Social Security system. So, you know, it's been going on for decades that we've been talking about a near bankrupt, insolvent Social Security system that's not going to be able to pay its bills. The government continues to talk about pushing up the age of retirement. It's already at 67 in terms of drawing benefits. So there's also that responsibility that many economists talk about, which is if you just stay in the workforce 4, 5, 6 more years in some capacity, doesn't have to be 90 hours a week, in some capacity, continue to earn and take some of the pressure off of the Social Security system. In fact, there might be more solvency for the generations to come. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there.
Yeah. John Stoll is with The Wall Street Journal. His piece is called The End of Retirement. John, thanks very much.
Anytime. You got it.
And now it's time for this morning's Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. And today, a volunteer in Pennsylvania who gives a lot more than just his time, Steve Hartman, met up with him.
There is a superhero in Pittsburgh, a mild-mannered guy in a funny-looking van who goes around town striking happiness in the hearts of hundreds.
If I can go out and help people and have them experience what love is just between neighbors, like, that's sweet.
Where's 270?
29-year-old John Potter is a handyman by trade, but he doesn't charge for most of what he does.
Do you mind starting it up?
Whether it's a pizza delivery guy with no way to deliver, or an electric scooter guy with no way to scoot.
Yeah.
John is always to the rescue.
Actually, let's throw it in the back.
Like, just like a saint, pretty much. He's willing to help anybody with whatever size problem you have.
It might take me a day, honestly.
John finds his rescuees on Reddit. People who have a window broken out, or can't afford the roof they need, or maybe just want help moving. John does it all for total strangers.
That took a huge brain switch.
He started doing this 4 years ago after a woman approached him at this gas station.
And she's like, hey, can I get a ride to the battered women's shelter, or can I have money for the bus?
And your answer?
I said, no, sorry.
It was a response he regretted almost immediately.
Yeah, that haunted me right from the start.
John vowed from that day forward he would say yes to anyone who asked for help, no matter what they needed. And so far, he's done about 1,000 good deeds. Has he ever been scammed? He doesn't know. And quite frankly, he doesn't care.
I give because I want to give, and that's just for me. And if anything, I go to bed and I feel happy. Yeah, come on in.
Happy, but not wealthy.
Is the check okay?
Typically, John has just a few $100s to his name. And yet he continues to give, sometimes a lot more than just handyman services.
Would you mind carrying it to the car? After the kidney surgery, I can't lift anything.
That's right. John has now moved on to vital organs.
It's unbelievable.
Last month, Michael Moore, another total stranger, got John's kidney.
This is not fixing somebody's scooter.
No, it's an unbelievable act of kindness.
Michael says the best gift ever, but not only for the obvious reason.
Because you find out that there's other people in the world that care. And that's a strong message.
A message that John says is only going to get louder.
I really want to give a piece of my liver.
Are you joking?
No. If the grave is home plate, I want to come sliding into it at this point, you know? Bare minimum organs. I don't know, you might find me on My Strange Addiction. Like, I'm addicted to giving organs.
There are certainly worse vices.
That's CBS's Steve.
Wow. And it's 7:49, time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. Here she is, Stacy Ross from Tom, Jake, and Stacy. And some career moves here on opposite sides. And I don't really know these guys. I've sort of heard their names. But Larry Fitzgerald, who was, I guess, the best-known receiver on the Arizona Cardinals, at the age of 36, has decided to sign another one-year contract. He'll come back for his 17th season. And then you have Luke Kuechly, is it? Linebacker for the Panthers, retiring at the age of 28. And he's apparent. Well, let's talk about Luke. It sounds like he's one of those who's decided that the concussions just aren't worth it.
Yeah, so he, just as a background for fans who are maybe unfamiliar, he and Bobby Wagner have kind of rotated for the top linebacker in the NFL. He's widely considered, I think outside of Seattle, where a lot of people consider it to be Bobby Wagner, but I think outside of Seattle, a lot of fans consider him to be the best linebacker in the NFL. He's had a very storied season with Carolina, consistently been one of, if not their most consistent performer, but he's had, I think, 8 concussions in his career, and that goes back to his start time in 2012, so who knows how many he had at Boston. I think he was at Boston College or Boston. But I think that is what people are assuming is behind this. He didn't come out and say it, but I think that most people, given his history of concussions, are assuming that maybe he was told by a doctor or medical professional that he was running a risk getting a few more.
Yeah. So he gets a pretty good retirement, though, right? I mean, he won't have to worry about money.
No, I mean, I'm sure he'll be fine, but I think it's just hard for someone like that to walk away in his prime. You think about it, at 28, which is the age he's retiring at right now, Bobby Wagner got an extension at 29. So Luke Kuechly could have still gotten, a big contract extension. He was still, you know, in his prime. He's aging out of it, but different careers in the NFL age at different paces. 29 for a linebacker isn't old for a linebacker.
Yeah. Looking at the Seahawks now, you have how many people are going to be free agents? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Oh, gosh.
Like 10?
Probably a little more than that, but I don't know off the top of my head, but some really important ones for sure.
Well, like Luke Wilson, George Fant, Mike Iupati. So we'll give me, who do you think should be the Seahawks' priority in terms of keeping people?
I think the Seahawks' priority is going to be Jadeveon Clowney.
Yeah.
So he's not one that people would think of because he's not a longtime Seahawk. But when he came to Seattle as part of that trade, he was under a franchise tag. And because it was past a certain deadline when the Seahawks would be able to extend him, they had to take on the franchise tag, which is effectively a one-year deal. So he becomes an unrestricted free agent March 17th or 15th, whenever the start of the new league year is. And the Seahawks have made it clear, Pete Carroll made it clear in his final interview with 710 ESPN, that he wants to re-sign Clowney. And it's a good idea. He was their best defensive lineman.
Yeah, yeah, he was always in the opposing quarterback's face. So I hear $20 million being thrown around. Would he get that much?
No, for sure. Yes. I would not be surprised if it was a little bit more than that. And that's what makes it tough for Seattle, because Clowney said that he wants to play for a contender, which on the one hand, usually bad teams have a lot of cap room, meaning a lot of money to spend. It doesn't sound like he's willing to go to one of those teams. So that does narrow some of the competition for Seattle, because a bad team would probably be willing to give him $22 plus million.
Yeah.
But it does make it a little harder to barter. He's not going to take like a team-friendly discount. He's going to look for the money that he's worth.
Yeah, and that's, we're talking $20 million per year. That's not the whole package. That's per year.
No,
right?
Per year, which sounds like a ton of money to people, and it is. But you have to think that each year teams have upwards of, I think the cap this year will probably be 96 or, excuse me, 196. So people have a lot of, teams have a lot of money to spend.
Stacy Rost, our sports insider. Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you.
First, Hannah Scott is here. And last year, our state lawmakers took their most aggressive action yet to make sure that some 10,000 backlogged rape kits finally got tested. But the work isn't done. So how much progress has been made?
A significant amount of progress on the number. So the 10,000 kits, I believe the old backlog kits were somewhere in the area of 2,000 that have been tested now. I will say that there is a new lab that is expected to come online about the middle of this year that is expected to really make a huge dent in that and get that wrapped up. But they're definitely making progress. And that's because largely of the bill that passed last year that was Democratic Representative Tina Orwell's bill. It was huge. It covered a lot of funding to get that new lab, more staff, and start to get to work on those backlogged kits. It also had a lot of new rules to make sure all those kits were tested and avoid future backlogs. But Representative Orwell says it's not enough.
We want to do more than test. If we're truly going to find justice and really take dangerous people off the streets, we need the ability to investigate and really potentially prosecute and find justice.
Orwell detailed her new proposal before a House Public Safety Committee yesterday. Among other things, this bill focuses on making sure that all the evidence is gathered and stored properly to give investigators and prosecutors their best shot at finding the bad guys and getting a conviction.
I want to make sure all of the DNA and the kit stays together. We were finding that other collections, such as urine or blood samples or other things, wasn't necessarily being kept with the kit, and that might be key to the investigation. So we want to make sure within our tracking system we note the other pieces of evidence.
There's also a new requirement on how long to store unreported rape kits. Now, those are kits that are collected when someone is sexually assaulted, but they're not ready to go to the police yet. This is a really huge issue because not everybody is ready to go to the cops right away after suffering that kind of trauma, as the committee heard from survivors like Leah Griffin yesterday.
There are many reasons why a survivor might choose not to report. They're financially dependent on their abuser. They fear not being believed. They want to finish college. They think the police might not investigate. Nobody goes out and gets a rape kit for fun. It's hours of prodding and dehumanization.
But there are some concerns about that, according to James McMahon with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, who spoke out against this proposal yesterday for a few different reasons. The big one, though, including the requirement for local law enforcement to store those unreported rape kits for up to 20 years. Here's their issue.
Local law enforcement agencies happen to be the ones who got the benefit of being asked by everybody else to store these. In our view, these are not evidence. These will be evidence. Absolutely. They should be stored. They should be secured. But getting into the practice of having law enforcement agencies store materials that are not yet evidence, that's a precedent that we're not comfortable setting.
So essentially, because there's no open criminal case, because mm-hmm. the person who was raped isn't ready to, they have the sexual assault kit done, but they're not ready to go to the police and start an investigation. And here's why. This is Leah Griffin again, survivor.
Today, we heard testimony that this isn't evidence, that the police are not in the business of storing things that don't have an open investigation. And they say this knowing that in their locker rooms they have lost items, wallets, jewelry, bicycles. And at the moment that bicycles that have been lost are receiving more care by the police than sexual assault kits, that argumentation is re-traumatizing and it's offensive.
So, and you look puzzled. So you
if somebody's not going to prosecute, how long do you wait for them to make up their mind?
Up through the statute of limitations. And I think in this case, they're asking that these be saved for 20 years. And it's important to keep those. I can't stress it enough. There are a multitude of reasons that a sexual assault survivor is not ready to go to the police.
Right.
And so that's why they're really trying to make sure that these unreported kits are stored. So when that person is ready, they've got that access to that kit. And not only just the rape kit, which, as we've talked about in previous years, is such an hours-long ordeal to go through something like that and to have it not available.
Okay,
when
so
in other words,
you don't even have a rape kit unless somebody volunteers to go through it then.
Absolutely. Unless, if I'm the sexual assault victim, I have to go to the hospital and get that forensic nurse to do it. And then
it's fair to make the presumption that somebody who's willing to subject herself to that, but yet hasn't made up her mind, might well think better of it later.
Absolutely. And that's actually common. It happens quite often that they could decide somewhere down a year, 2 years down the line that they're ready to do it for whatever reason. I want to point out quickly, there's a couple of other things here. A really, really important aspect of this bill is that there are some people who are arrested for violent crimes or sexually related crimes that are, for whatever reason, they don't end up going straight into lockup. So right now, there's no they are required to give DNA, but they're supposed to self-report, right, and go and do that on their own at a separate point if they're not going to be put directly into jail for whatever reason, if they bail or whatever. Mm-hmm. This would make sure that immediately it is taken in that first court appearance so that they can't be missed and that information is then put into CODIS, that federal database, to make sure that we can match that to some other sexual predator or cold cases like we've seen in some of the DNA cases that have been filed.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Who listens to you is the question that Kate Murphy posed for her book, You're Not Listening. What prompted you to write a book simply about how to listen to people?
You know, I wrote this book because despite living in a world that's all talk, listening is actually the more powerful position in communication. You learn when you listen. It's how we understand. It's how we connect. It's how we cooperate. It's how we fall in love. And yet, you know, I noticed what I think a lot of us have noticed is that it's becoming increasingly difficult to listen. I mean, more than half of the population says that they do not have a meaningful in-person conversation with another person on a daily basis, and also that they often feel lonely.
So what do you do about that? I think most people know the feeling when they find themselves talking, but their audience is not at all engaged. So when you find yourself in a situation like that, how do you break out of it?
Well, you listen, and that's not as simple as it sounds. Listening is something that is really a cultivated skill, and it's something that degrades, like most skill, if you don't do it often enough. And that's what I really wanted my book to be, was a practical guide. Each chapter looks at a different aspect of listening. But, you know, if I want to give somebody, you know, your listeners, a practical tip to put into place right now, you know, when you're talking to someone, make sure that your goal in the conversation is to learn something about the other person. Mm-hmm. Everyone is interesting if you listen to them and ask the right questions. That's, I'm sure, something you've learned as a journalist as well, that, you know, everyone has got a story. You just need to be patient and listen and ask the right questions.
I think that's absolutely true. And then there's the other thing. What about if you, as a listener, are afraid of hearing something that might change your mind in a way that makes you uncomfortable?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think that underlies a lot of what's going on politically, where people cannot bear to listen to somebody who has opposing views. And when I talked to researchers about this, they actually hooked up people to fMRIs and looked at their brain patterns while their deeply held beliefs are being challenged. Mm-hmm. And it was the same brain pattern that they would have as if they were being chased by a bear. Like,
really?
It was an existential threat. And so when people are listening to others and start getting that feeling that, you know, like, I can't listen to this person, you know, I don't agree with this person, and, you know, they're not worth my time, I'm not listening, take a deep breath and realize you're not under physical threat, because that's what your primitive brain is telling you. And when your primitive brain is, you know, in that fight or flight stance, you can't listen. And so it's take a deep breath and ask a question. Try and find out how that person landed on the opinion that they have. And it's not so, you know, you can change your mind, though that might happen, but it's really to understand. You can't really be firm in your position unless you really understand the opposite side. And you also can't craft a good argument unless you understand the other person's logic and where they're coming from. So listening helps you on both counts. You can speak better because you have to know your audience to land a message well. And you also, it makes you more at ease. You have, there's something that they call cognitive complexity, and it is what helps us be really our sharpest and help us come up with better ideas, to develop patterns. And that is being able to hold contradictory views in our head at the same time. Nothing is black and white, and it's not scary if you just take a deep breath and say, I'm going to understand this, instead of be scared of it.
Does there come a time where you simply have to stop listening?
Yes, and I don't want anyone to think that my book is just kumbaya. You know, there does come a point. There are only so many hours in the day. And so we all make choices about who we listen to and for how long, and that's really the power of the listener. You are what you attend to in life, and you have to make choices. And there is a wonderful British scholar who talks about how we decide what we're going to listen to, that we all subconsciously have expectations in conversation, because conversation is essentially cooperative. And if you perceive that the other person's not cooperating in this conversation, you're going to want out of the deal. And the expectations are quality, quantity, relation, and manner. And quality is, we expect the truth. Someone starts lying to us, you know, we check out of the conversation. And quantity, if they're giving us way too much information, you know, like somebody telling you in excruciating detail about their colonoscopy,
yes.
You know, you do start to tune out. And then relation, that it has to be logical. It has to have a sense of relevance and logical flow. And then finally, manner. It has to be, you know, unambiguous. It has to be reasonably brief as well. And so if anybody violates any of those things, then that's when you start to check out. But, you know, a lot of times I talk about in the book that listening is not something you should only do when another person's talking. You should also be doing it while you are talking,
yeah,
and really getting a sense from the other person. Am I violating any of these? And if you're even having a hard time sensing that, you can just say to the other person, too much? Am I going on too long?
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can have a better conversation. That it's really this wonderful dance where you're incredibly engaged and it's fun. And we've all felt that. Like you met somebody at a cocktail party and it was a different kind of conversation where you're just like, I really enjoy talking,
yes,
to that person.
It goes really well.
Really connected with that person.
Right, right.
It's the great conversation.
You're Not Listening is Kate Murphy's book, What You're Missing and Why It Matters. And the neuroscience part, those coordinated brainwaves, I find just especially fascinating that science has been able to actually detect when you're paying attention and when you feel threatened by what's being said.
It's fascinating. Fascinating how it lines up exactly to how we feel.
Kate Murphy, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Could you describe the debris and the rubble where the vehicle containing the two bodies was found?
It's just a mass of rock and mud, trees and snow.
What type of equipment are you using?
We're using picks and shovels.
This must be backbreaking work.
Well, it is.
It was just over the border from Washington 55 years ago this week when an event now known as the Hope Slide wiped out a long section of a provincial highway in British Columbia. The highway department in BC had just marked the anniversary by sharing some long-lost images. And our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here with a look back brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, and this is the Hope Rock Slide. It's a huge slide. It took place on a Saturday morning. This was January 9th, 1965. It's about 12 miles southeast of the Fraser Valley community of Hope, not too far from Harrison Hot Springs and on the way to Manning Provincial Park, if you know BC geography. The anniversary was this week, and I spoke with Kristen Reimer of the British Columbia Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure.
Nobody's forgotten about it. It's still visible if you drive through the area. BC Highway 3 was actually buried by it for almost 3 kilometers, and I don't know how you convert that into miles, but it's still a part of sort of our culture and our history. We were all overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the slide itself, and it's still a scar on the side of the mountain, and it's hard not to see when you drive through the area.
Now, Highway 3 dates back to the 1860s when a surveyor named Edgar Dewdney was commissioned by the provincial government to create a route for prospectors in the gold rushes of that era. So this is a pretty mountainous area. It's called the old Dewdney Trail. Now, what first happened 55 years ago was an avalanche around 4 a.m. that blocked the road with snow. This meant traffic was stopped on both sides. Now, some vehicles waited, but fortunately, most did not. Because at about 7 a.m., an almost incomprehensible amount of rock came down as about half of a mountain called Johnson Peak just let loose. Now, the result was death and destruction, but Kristen Reimer says it could have been a lot worse.
There were some people locally. I know we've heard from people who've said that there was a Greyhound bus that was stopped at the avalanche, and then they decided not to wait, and they turned around and they went back up the mountain towards Manning Park and towards Princeton there. Anybody who was at the site who was stopped and waiting for the avalanche to be cleared was unfortunately a victim to the second landslide.
Yeah, now this is considered one of the largest landslides in Canadian history, if not the largest. The quantity is something like 47 million cubic meters. It's half a mountain's worth of rock and mud and debris. It completely wiped out a lake. It covered about 2 miles of roadway, as deep as 500 feet in some places. Now the search and rescue effort was launched almost immediately. That was the sound we heard at the start of the piece here. And they ultimately recovered two bodies on the Sunday after the slide, a driver of a hay truck and the driver of a car. But two passengers who were in that car were never found, and this was all on the east side of the slide. Now, BC Highway 3 isn't just some country road. It's the southern alternative to the Trans-Canada Highway, which jags pretty far to the north at Hope.
It used to be called the Southern Trans-Provincial Highway, so what it did was it connected Vancouver area to the rest of the country of Canada, Alberta, and all the other provinces. And so when that highway was cut in 1965, it was a really significant closure. And so the Highways Department really had the pressure on to get that route reestablished.
You know, hearing Kristen Reimer talk about all this, it reminded me a lot of the Oso slide in 2014 and the collapse of the I-5 Skagit Bridge in 2013, that sort of huge search and rescue effort plus the work to reopen the highway. And remarkably, in just 13 days, the BC Highways Department managed to build a new temporary road essentially across the top and along the base of the slide.
And we've got a lot of pride here in keeping our highways open and stuff, and I know that our staffers really... Yeah, it was a big achievement. I mean, it was a somber achievement, and it was a serious time. But getting that road back open, yeah, it was a great thing.
And as part of her job, Kristen Reimer is always on the lookout for history of the Highways Department. And a few years ago, she inherited a bunch of boxes and materials from a previous employee. And that's where she recently discovered about 55 images of the slide, most of which have never before been made available to the public.
As far as I know, one or two of them were shared out in 1965 following the event, and then they were just kind of shelved. I think it was a really sensitive thing. It was a really large experience, a big thing that happened to us. And I think, you know, nobody really wanted to talk about it too much until just in recent years. And so I felt like the time was right to share it out. It's 55 years now since the event happened.
Yeah, and those images will now be preserved at the BC Provincial Archives. We have a gallery at My Northwest and links to everything that the BC Transportation and Infrastructure Ministry has put together to mark this 55th anniversary.
Ever found out what caused it?
You know, it was a geologic thing. They don't know for sure. It wasn't an earthquake, but somehow or other, half that mountain just geologically let loose. It might have been related to the snow. It might have been probably, you know, millennia in the making.
You can ring my bell, Rachel Bell.
Well, this is usually the time of the show when we hear from Rachel Bell with food features and cultural criticism. And she, of course, anchors the podcast, Your Last Meal, which is all about food. And when you prepare a meal, what do you have from time to time? You have leftovers. And since Rachel is not here today, we figured, well, we still have to fill the segment. So what do? So the staff decided that they would string together outtakes. Now, Rachel and I record these things because of our schedules. And one of the worst things you can do in radio is forget to press the record button. So my policy has always been that the moment I enter the studio, I flip the thing on and as we set things up. So the staff strung together all the leftovers that did not get on the air. And apparently this is the result. This was never meant to go on the radio, but here it is anyway.
Dear far, wherever you are.
Is this the part where I hold you from behind like in Titanic?
Yes.
And our hair blows on the ship?
Oh, yes.
I hope that's unrecorded, so James has to go through that when he edits it.
No. I always cut this stuff out because I don't want to annoy him. He gets into a mood. Don't you think part of the reason is you don't need friends anymore? Because as long as you have your smartphone, everything's at your fingertips right there.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Ride from the airport.
Well, I don't know why you didn't become a therapist. You have so many great thoughts and pieces of advice.
Yeah, they're all negative.
I know.
Dave, how to make friends. You don't need to make friends.
You don't need
Just
friends.
Just use your smartphone. But my smartphone leaves me lonely. Get used to it.
Well, I'll tell you, you should go back and listen to one of my past podcasts where we discussed this, and I can't remember which episode it is, so this is very useless. Hold on, I'm going to say that again, but with like actual information. This is a theme on our show,
yes.
Not knowing. Okay, I wonder which one that was. Let's see. Your Last Meal, KFC, Japanese Christmas.
I'll wait. Oh, there we go. Now something's happening.
Fine.
Because I had to press a button.
You are new here. I get it.
How many buttons do you need just to record two people talking? Look at all this stuff.
Most of it's just for show to look important.
That must be what it is. What happens if I press this?
As like my grandma late in life, she got this remote control and it had like six buttons on it. It was like volume, channel, power, huge buttons.
Yeah.
Tiny. It was all you need, really.
That's all you need.
You don't need all that stuff.
Okay, that's working. That's working.
Everything's working.
You're working.
You're working.
And here we are.
We're both literally working.
That's true.
Yeah.
Hard to believe.
It's our job. Give me some terrible advice. What should I do? Dave, sometimes I feel like I just have to be on all the time. Therapist Dave.
I would say find a dark room and sit there alone for a half hour.
Okay. I need to take a bath and a bunch of Snickers bars. I just need to recover.
Me, me, me.
Flem, flem, flem,
me,
flem.
Me, me,
me. Oh, God. Take it easy. It's only Tuesday. Beeble, beeble. Ay, ay, ay. That's what Tony Miner taught us. And then this one.
Bah, bah.
Did you get taught that step, too?
diaphragm eruption.
Is really? Do you think we put KFCs to get people to come to America?
That's what America is about. A guy in a white suit flinging chicken at you. That was pretty bad.
Me, boy!
Well, what do you expect? Early. Nobody's meant to talk this early in the morning. This is when you drive. You don't talk.
Yeah, but you tape those things at like 10:30 in the morning
when
you've already been here for 6 hours.
But then I'm tired.
Yeah, you're tired.
Ready for a nap.
Oh, that's awesome.
At my age. I should be napping a lot more than I do.